Well, good morning. My name is Prashant. I'm the Assistant Minister here. A particularly warm welcome if you're visiting with us this Good Friday morning. The idea of kingship is outdated in our culture. It's lost a lot of its meaning. For example, nowadays we have Storage King and Burger King and Donut King and White King, which is apparently a toilet cleaner. So to be a king is perhaps not what it used to be. Aura and power are things that are found elsewhere. On a long weekend, a police officer, for example, holds a lot of power. For example, if you are caught looking at your phone this weekend, you'll lose 8 points. And so they pull you over and you may break out in a slight cold sweat. And in our time and culture, someone like the President of the United States carries with them a great deal of aura. If you were to turn around in your pew and Barack Obama happened to be sitting, he's not behind you, by the way. If he was sitting behind you, you might let out a short gasp, for example. But, you know, in previous generations, kings held both aura and power. Both aura and power. And you gasped and you broke out in a cold sweat when you encountered a king. This is very much the case when it came to the Old Testament. In fact, it's the reason why throughout the Old Testament, the writers constantly call God's people to hold God as their one true king. Because in many ways, in the ultimate way, he was the king. He was the place where aura and power met together. And in fact, one of the rebukes that they often face is that God is not their one true king. With all this in mind, it's striking how John retells the events, these last hours of Jesus' life. We pick up the story, we join the account in this morning's passage, midway through the trial that's taking place with Jesus and Pilate. Pilate has already asked Jesus in the last few verses of chapter 18 the question, "Are you a king?" And that question seems to run through the early parts of this account as well. Pilate, in an attempt to kind of appease the crowd, sends Jesus to be flogged. Perhaps he thinks at this point, if Jesus is flogged brutally, the crowd will have their blood and leave. Because you get the sense that Pilate is not convinced Jesus deserves death. And so he sends it, and John focuses on this little moment of torture executed by the Roman soldiers. But when you read the account of this moment, what is striking is how little John says about physical pain. In fact, he doesn't describe the brutality of the event. What he rather focuses on is the mockery of the soldiers. The soldiers who twist a crown of thorns and place it on Jesus' head. The soldiers who clothe him in a robe and who mockingly say to him, "Hail, King of the Jews." I suspect John is not focusing on that by pure mistake or coincidence. There's a point being made here. And Jesus, brought back by the soldiers to Pilate, is presented. And John makes the point that he's presented in his robe. And he says, "Here is the man," looking ridiculous with a crown of thorns and a blood-stained robe. And hoping that the crowd might back down, he presents them, hoping they'll gaze upon this beaten body and have some mercy, but they cry, "Crucify him, crucify him." And so Pilate drags Jesus back in for another council, another moment of questioning. And this time the question revolves around power. And from Jesus' words, what we come to see is that perhaps Pilate doesn't hold the ultimate power in this exchange. Pilate, again, he seems to be convinced, actually, that Jesus is not deserving of this crucifixion. and yet hearing the growing unrest, worrying about his own power perhaps, he sends Jesus out and he presents to the crowd and he says mockingly, "Here is your king," again. They shout, "Take him away, take him away." And then he says again, "Shall I crucify your king?" And the crowd cry out, "We have no king but Caesar." Do you see the theme that John is developing, the things that he's focusing on in this account? Pilate therefore orders his execution, and Jesus is swiftly taken to the mountain where he'll be nailed to the cross and crucified. And again, what we notice is there is little description about the physical suffering of Jesus on the cross. What is of focus and of interest to John as he recounts these events is the sign that is above Jesus' head. It read, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." The Jewish leaders again protest, but Pilate writes, "What I have written, I have written." And there it is, this sign above Jesus' body, "Jesus of Nazareth, the King of the Jews." See, John's point is that in what we encounter on Good Friday, we see the extraordinary moment of God's crowning his son, the coronation of Jesus Christ. He puts kingship right at the center of his account because for him, this is when the crown is finally placed on Jesus' head as the true king, not just of the Jews, but of the world. I think that's why he includes that sign with three different languages, because he wants to say this doesn't just apply to the Jewish people. He is the king of the Jews and the Greeks and the surrounding world. And this is actually what makes Good Friday good. See, often we think about Good Friday as good because from an existential perspective, we think, great, my sins are forgiven. And that is, of course, true. But what makes Good Friday fundamentally good is that God's king has finally been coronated. The crown has finally been placed on his head. Now, for some of us here, this is just way too contradictory to reconcile. Because what we hear is someone acclaiming someone as a king, but what we see and perceive and encounter is a beaten, naked man on a cross. When we think of kings and queens, we imagine grand coronations. We imagine pomp and ceremony, walking down the aisle of an abbey. We imagine crowns with jewels glittering in them and flowing robes. But for John, God's great coronation has a crown of thorns, a naked and beaten body, lots cast for their clothes. How can there be anything powerful about this moment? Yet that is exactly what we're confronted with at Good Friday. That's exactly what we're confronted with. And John says, you can't call Jesus king unless you are willing to see the cross as his great coronation, where the crown is finally put on his head. And for those of us who find that hard to reconcile, perhaps what is problematic is not John's account and reading of the events, but what we consider to be powerful and glorious. What we consider to be the work of God and the expression of his divinity to us. For all the Gospels, the decisive moment in their retelling is here at the cross of Jesus Christ. The resurrection, of course, plays a great part in the story. We turn our minds to that on Sunday. But it is interesting that at all of them, great things, phenomenal things take place at this moment, which mark an acknowledgement that Jesus Christ stands above everyone else. In Mark, it is when Jesus breathes his last that the centurion at the foot of the cross acclaims him as the Son of God. In Matthew, it is when Jesus dies that the temple curtain is torn in two, that the earth shakes and that tombs are opened. And even in Luke, it is the centurion again who acknowledges Jesus as the righteous one. When? At the moment of his death. But why does John see Jesus' death as his coronation? Well, there's lots of reasons. I mean, just as John's story has travelled, lots of things in his account have been pointing to this moment. It may not have been clear to us at the time, but there have been hints throughout, and now as we gaze at the cross, we see that all those hints for John were pointing to this. But on a broader scale, John's point is not simply that within his book and his reading of Jesus' life, everything is pointing to the cross, but within the grand scheme of the world's history and God's work in it and God's prophecy and God's teaching to his people, the cross stands at the very center, at the very apex, at the place where all prophecy converges. If we look even through this passage, we see hints at it. Some of them are quite implicit and subtle, but as we get closer and closer to the moment of Jesus' death, they become more and more overt. If you're a Jew, you'd pick up a lot of these things straight away because the law is seeped through your thinking. In verse 17, when Jesus goes out of the city, a Jewish person would automatically think of the law, which required an executed person to be executed outside the camp. I wonder, did that provision actually, was that actually written for this moment? When it talks about Jesus being nailed with two others, one on either side, I think perhaps of Isaiah, who talks about the king being numbered with the transgressors, or David's great psalm, Psalm 22, which talks about he as a king being encircled by evil men. All these little subtle hints. But John really drives it home as we get closer. In verse 24, he actually quotes one of King David's Psalms. Jesus taking the words of a king upon his own lips. And then again in verse 28 and verse 36 and verse 37. All of these prophecies, all these promises coming to fulfillment. So when Jesus says it is finished, he's saying, I draw the full stop at the end of all God's speaking. I am what everything is leading to. And that's John's point. That's exactly why he is king for John. Jesus is king because all of God's plans are about him. Everything has been leading to this moment that we recognize and reflect upon this morning. And like the lineage of great kings and queens, Jesus' coronation spreads back generation upon generation. Extraordinarily to the beginning of time, we're told. This isn't a coronation that comes about because Jewish leaders and Pilate are struggling for power. It comes about because this is God's great plan finalized, fulfilled, finished in Jesus. But why does it matter that the cross is where we see Jesus declared as king? Why does John go to so much effort to draw this out as he is describing the crucifixion event? Why not finish his story with the resurrection and then declare Jesus as king with power? Well, I think it's because it says a lot about how we're meant to respond to Jesus. The HBO teledrama Band of Brothers has at its heart the story of two captains, Captain Sobel and Captain Winter. He traces actually a group of men who landed on Normandy on D-Day and go through Europe to the end of the war together. And these two captains kind of bookend the stories. Sobel is their training captain. And they follow him because he has rank, he wears a uniform, he's an officer in the army. But Sobel is cruel and vindictive. And while the men may follow him, they hate him. But Captain Winter, well, he doesn't even start as a captain, actually. Captain Winter is the man who storms Normandy with them, who's at the front of that onslaught. He's the man who's in the trenches with them. He's the man who suffers through the deep winter in Bastogne, and he's the man who drags many of them from death himself. And by the end of the movie, end of the series, you come to grasp a group of brothers who will follow Captain Winter anywhere that he asks them. Not just because he's an officer, not just because he wears a uniform or he carries a rank, but because he has loved them deeply and they love him too. And this is what the events of Good Friday do to those people who believe. John calls on us to believe, having heard these events, soon after he retells them. See, if Jesus was just a king on a throne, you might submit to him out of fear. His authority over you might compel you out of fear, out of obligation, out of duty, out of anxiety. But because Jesus is the king who goes to the cross for you, you submit to him out of love and thanksgiving and adoration. Good Friday is a call for us to submit to the king who goes to the cross for us. Love so amazing, so divine, demands my life, my soul, my all. Amen.